I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
For episode 52 of the Intercooler podcast, we're going to be jumping around a little bit, lots of topics to discuss, none of which, though, Andrew, are sort of more important than Sabine Schmitz passing away. We heard the news very sadly last week that she died. She'd been battling cancer. She was only 51 years old, and it's just so sad. I think the sort of outpouring of respect and admiration for her on social media was extraordinary, and it made me realise actually how liked and respected she was.
Yeah, I mean, what surprised me was the way it actually went. It went way beyond it being the sad news of her passing, way beyond our world. I can remember looking at, you know, if you go on the BBC website, and there's always this sort of thing of what's the most read thing on the website, and she was right up there. And it's not as if there's not a lot of news around at the moment in other parts of the world. And, you know, she clearly had a connection to people way beyond what we think is the sort of rather small enclave of people who, you know, idiots like us who do what we do. She was on Top Gear, but she wasn't on there, you know, all the time. And yet there was something about her that was, I think the thing about her is, you know, very, very sadly, I never met her. And I would have just loved to, because she just struck me as being absolutely authentic. You know, there are some people who go on there and you can see, well, that's fine, they're presenting. And you can imagine that, in fact, I've met some of them. You know, guys like someone like Harris is absolutely off the camera, the same person that he is on the camera. And others clearly are not. And Sabine, you could just sort of see that's the person. And, you know, that bright, warm, bubbly, but still strong and impressive, not to mention super talented person that is, you know, coming out the screen at you, is quite clearly who she was. And I think that, you know, all the stuff that she did, and more importantly, the way that she did all that stuff, always with a smile on her face, always aware of how lucky she was to be able to do what she did, is probably what people connected to. And it's just, yeah, I mean, you know, coming after Murray, and, you know, Murray passing, you know, he was an absolute legend, obviously, but he was 97, you know. I don't think any of us would complain if we went at that age, but 51, you know, I'm 55. It just doesn't seem fair, does it? And it's just really, really sad. And, you know, the people I know who did know her are in bits about it, and understandably so.
Mm. Yeah, I think her profile more generally, it really stemmed from that first appearance on Top Gear, didn't it? When Clarkson went out there in a diesel S-Type.
Yeah, I could beat that in a van.
I could do that lap time in a van. And that one line really rocketed her to a kind of superstardom. Also with, you know, just the average man in the street. I think I wrote that in a piece that we posted when she passed away. I said that to the man in the street, she will always be the German woman who mocked Clarkson with that immortal line. But she was really a heroic figure at the Nürburgring long before she ever appeared on television. She won the 24-hour race there twice in the 90s, back-to-back wins. She's still the only woman to have won the race. And she was smoking everybody in the ring taxi long before she appeared on Top Gear, wasn't she?
Yeah, and I can remember going to one of my early trips out there, long before she was on Top Gear, and she was a sufficient legend that, you know, I just wanted to go in the ring taxi because you just do, don't you? You go there, you know, everybody's got to have a run around the ring taxi. And just really, really hoping that it was going to be Sabine driving, and it wasn't. It was some hairy ass bloke, and you know, and that was fine. But even then, she was an absolute local legend. Yeah, what a loss, what a shame.
I know. Do you know what? It's a horribly clinical way of measuring these things. But when I look at the stats, right, on our Insta post where we announced that she'd passed away, they're just extraordinary for us. That post has been liked almost 13,000 times. Now, if a normal post gets liked 1,300 times, we'll think that's done quite well, haven't we? Wouldn't we? But 13,000 is just well beyond our normal expectations. I know there's a bit of Instagram algorithm there, but it does demonstrate to me just how popular she was.
Yeah. Yeah, about people identified with her, how people admired her, connected with her. Yeah, I mean, it was lovely to see that, you know, that people felt, you know, sufficiently strongly about it just to sort of, even if you just sort of click that like thing, it's just sort of saying, yeah, I get this, I understand this, I know who this person was. And we share in that sense of loss at her passing.
Mm. Yeah, we definitely do. Ah, well, bless her. Okay. So let's move on then, Andrew. Another thing that we posted on Instagram last week was about our new tagline. We've got a new tagline. That's fun, isn't it? The point is, we have a new digital magazine on the way. And over the next few days, next couple of weeks, you're going to hear everything there is to hear about it. We're going to tell you who's going to be writing for us, because it's not just you and me, Andrew. We've got a whole team of people lined up. And we're shooting for the stars with this thing. It's going to be a much, much bigger product than the Intercooler or Drive Nation ever has been. And so just stay tuned, because we will tell you more. Yeah. But we needed a tagline.
Sorry, just before you do that, the one thing I would just add in there is that, you know, whatever we're going to go and do, and we're really excited about it. It is unlike anything else that's been done, and the people we're going to be working with just kind of, I barely believe it's going to happen. But nevertheless, what isn't going to change is the Instagram site. So, you know, the 43,000 people who follow us, and we're still going to be doing that every day. That's not going to change. So I don't want anybody to think that, you know, whatever we're going to do is going to be instead of. It's not. It's going to be as well as. So I just think that's an important point to get across. Sorry.
Yeah, fair enough. That's okay. No, you're quite right. And nor are we putting what we've been doing for almost 3 years behind a paywall. That's not what we're doing. It's going to be much, much bigger, much more ambitious, much grander. And I think you'll like it. But we needed a tagline. So we needed something just to embody what it was that we stood for. And we went back and forth on this for weeks, didn't we?
I mean, the funny thing is that everybody who listens to this podcast, I mean, people are very kind about it, but occasionally they do say, I do wish you two would stop agreeing with each other. Yeah. And it's true, because we think quite similarly in about things like cars. We do end up thinking, you know, quite, you know, the same sort of thing about a thing. We didn't think similarly about our tagline at all. And, you know, however much we may agree in public, in private, you know, we struggle with this. We came up with all sorts of stuff, and, you know, you were sort of, well, you know, lukewarm what I was saying, and I was, you know, fairly tepid, and we just couldn't think of what it's going to be. We knew what we wanted to say, but we needed like 20 words to say it, and you can't do that. It's got to be short, and it's got to be snappy, and it's got to endure. So it can't even be some, you know, some fun play on words, because those things, you know, once you've heard the joke, you kind of heard the joke. So it's just got to be something which is real and short and snappy and punchy. And we couldn't think of it, could we?
Have you got the book on your shelf behind you?
Oh.
is it out of reach somewhere?
No, it's not. It's right here. It's right by my side. So, yes. There it is.
There it is. If you're watching on YouTube, you'll be able to see that Andrew's holding a book called Where the Writer Meets the Road. It's a book by Sam Posey. And we've adopted that as our own, that title, Where the Writer Meets the Road. That is the Intercaller's new tagline. I think it speaks about, our magazine is going to be full of the best writing that there is out there, okay? So it's important that we get across the message that we are a team of writers, okay? That's what we do first and foremost. And Where the Writer Meets the Road. Lots of titles are more interested in industry or in design or whatever it is. We're about cars and driving, right? So we have to get that across as well. And so it just works really well for us, doesn't it? But there's an added significance.
Yeah. So this came about because you and I were in a meeting. We have an investor who's an amazing bloke and has been a colossal help to us in many, many more ways than helping us out a bit on the financial side. But we were kind of having this conversation with him. We were just going, we can't think of anything. And I was casting around these bookshelves up here, kind of in desperation, looking around for inspiration. And then I just suddenly saw it. I just saw this, you know, Where the Writer Meets the Road, down there. And I held that up. And he just said, that's it. That's it. And in six words, Sam Posey had said everything that we wanted to. So, I suppose we could have just thought, well, we're just going to do it. We'll just go and nick it. Because, you know, it's not copyrighted or anything. But when I was editing Motorsport a million years ago, I once got... So, let me tell you who Sam is for people who don't know
Please
him.
Please do.
Because there's every reason he shouldn't, because, you know, he's not a famous bloke in motor racing. Well, he should be. He did a couple of F1 races. I think he started a couple of US Grand Prix. But he did a lot of IndyCar racing over there. He did a lot of Trans Am racing. And he did a lot of sports car racing. So in 1970 and 1971, people always remember those are the 917 years, because 917s just took everything. And yeah, fine. If you weren't in 917, you weren't winning the race or getting anywhere near it. The first car home in both of those 917 years was a Ferrari 512 driven by Sam. So that's kind of the level.
That wasn't a 917, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And they were private cars. So these weren't even like works factory cars with all the best bits on them. So that gives you an idea of, you know, what a great peddler this bloke is. I commissioned him to write a story about Mark Donohue back in the days when I was editing Motorsport. Because I just wanted somebody who knew him, and I didn't know anybody who did, but Brian Redman told me that Sam Posey was great mates with him. And I didn't even realise that Sam could write, but I just sort of kind of rang him up and said, well, can you do it? I'm thinking to myself, I have to rewrite it when it comes to it. And this story came in, and it was just beautiful. It was just absolutely beautiful. The sort of thing that if a bona fide, paid-up, permanent, full-time professional journalist had written, I would just be going, wow, that's fantastic. And this guy could just... He just writes so beautifully. So when we decided that this was the thing, you know, I needed to get his blessing. I just couldn't nick his idea. And I'd lost his contacts, but I got hold of David Hobbs, who is another great underrated British racing driver who's been living in the States for years. And he actually wrote the foreword for that book. So David gave me Sam's contacts. Sam is 76 now. He's had Parkinson's for years, so he's not in the best of health. But he just said yes. He just said, great idea, good luck, help yourself. And it was just lovely. So, you know, not only have we got the name, but we've got the man's approval to use it too. So, yeah, thank you, Sam. I don't suppose you'll ever see this, but if you do, really, seriously appreciate it. And, we hope that you agree with us that it's, when you see what we're up to, that it is the best way in six short words of defining what we're all about.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it works as a tagline on its own, but the fact that it's the title of Sam Posey's book just gives it that extra dimension, doesn't it? And so this guy was a phenomenally skillful driver and, by all accounts, a great writer as well. I suppose that's what you and I are shooting for and will always shoot for the rest of our careers and get hopelessly nowhere near. But there we go. You've got to aim for something, haven't you? So there we go. That's why we have this tagline. It's great, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I will never, ever be able to drive a tenth as well as Sam Posey could drive. But I thought I might be able to outright the average racing driver. But actually, now I've seen what he's written. I'm not sure that I can. But seriously, anybody who's interested in the story, go and get a copy of this. Go and read the story he writes about. He did a big bit in there about trying to sleep at night when your teammate's out in the car at Le Mans. It's absolutely, I mean, I just, you know, it's just for pure writing. It's beautiful stuff. It's as good writing as I've ever read in the field of automotive journalism. And he's not even a journalist. How annoying is that?
Oh, that is so irritating, isn't it? That's really frustrating. You and I work our socks off trying to write, yes, and this bloke comes along. He's also stood at the podium at Le Mans and does better than us. Oh, well.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. We're quite happy to give that book a plug, Sam Posey, Where the Writer Meets the Road. And that's our tagline. Yeah. Good. Okay, well, let's keep clipping on. I want to talk about Jenson Button.
Because, oh, yes, of course. You and Jens have been chatting, haven't you?
We've been chatting, yeah. Now, he's got a new project, which is relaunching Radford, a British coach builder from the 50s and 60s. And they did some interesting stuff back in the day with Rolls-Royces and Bentleys and Minis. Quite a famous name from coach building, actually. And Button is bringing it back with a bunch of others, including Ant Anstead, the TV presenter and car builder. Also a British, another third British guy called Mark Stubbs, who's a designer, and an American chap called Roger, who's the sort of the business brains behind the operation, I suppose. So they're bringing this company back, and it basically gave me an opportunity to sit on a Zoom call with the bunch of them, including Jenson, which I was just so delighted about because the bloke is a hero of mine. I remember I had a slightly unusual introduction to Formula One because about the time where I was becoming aware of it, we were right in the midst of the Schumacher-Ferrari years. And you're not going to get hooked on that. I suppose it's similar to the Hamilton era at the moment. As a newcomer, you're not going to get hooked on the sport if it appears that the same bloke's winning every other weekend.
Even if you're a fan of the bloke.
Yeah.
It's just not exciting,
that's right,
is it? Yeah.
It's not exciting. And there's this young British guy who seemed like a lot of fun called Jenson Button. And most of the time he was, you know, hanging around mid-pack or towards the back of the grid somewhere. But then there was that racing in Hungary. Was it 05 or 06? I forget. I think it was 05, wasn't it? And he won a race, an F1 race for the first time. And I was so excited. I leapt out of my skin. You know, it was like my football team had won the Premier League or something. I loved it. And from that moment, I was hooked. The trouble is, Button then had his lean years, didn't he? That Honda Earth Dream car. And all of a sudden, my favourite driver's just at the back of the field. And there's not a lot of fun to be had from watching that happen.
But he never complained, did he? Or if he did, it was so rare. And I just thought that really spoke about the calibre of the man. Because, you know, there was that talent, you know, a talent that we know was good enough to win a world championship. And thank goodness he got that opportunity. And yet all those years in those cars that just weren't as good as the bloke who was driving them. And he was just always the team player, wasn't he? He was always just, you know, well, we're going to keep on plugging with him. And he kept a smile on his face. And, you know, you wrote a thesis, didn't you, on the Intercooler last week about drivers flouncing off and getting, you know, hot on the collar and shirty without perhaps necessarily realising how lucky they are to be doing that job in the first place. And he was never like that. And he, almost more than any of them, had grounds to.
Yeah, really, that's impressive. Right. And then 2009 happened for him. He won the championship and he was a hero of mine from that moment on. I kind of feel that he had a couple of good seasons after that with McLaren, didn't he? He won a handful of races. But he was never in a championship-winning McLaren or a championship-competitive McLaren. And I just think if he had been perhaps a few years earlier at that team, maybe he... Or if the McLaren had been better during that sort of 2010 to 2013 period, perhaps he would have nicked a couple more titles or at least one more. So
I think you've also got to look... I mean, I know a lot of people, and in fact, I fear I might have been one of them, who saw his move to McLaren and thought, well, why are you going to go up against Lewis? Because you're just going to get lunched. And he didn't. You know, he was, you know, okay, there was Fernando at the beginning. But since then, I mean, you know, he was the most competitive teammate that Lewis ever had. And actually, I did it once. I went and looked at their stats and looked at it. And there was like this between them. Can I tell my Jensen Button story?
You can.
Okay.
Go for it.
I can't remember when this was, but it was probably 8-9 years ago. And I was at the Goodwood Festival of Speed, and a client, can't remember who, had asked me to go round on the Sunday afternoon to various famous people in the Drivers Club and just ask them one question, which was, what's the most impressive thing you've seen this weekend? And I was doing this, and various people were talking about various people who'd driven various cars, and that was fine. And then I got to Stirling Moss. And I said to him, what's the most impressive thing you saw this week? And he went, oh, it was Jensen. I thought, oh, that's fair enough. I think Jensen had been up in the Brawn or something. And I said, what? He drove it really well, didn't he? He said, oh, I didn't see him drive the car. Oh, I don't know what you mean then. He said, well, he'd gone up in something. And he said, I was at the top. And if you haven't driven at the Goodwood Festival of Speed, and I'm guessing not many people listening to this will have done, what happens is once you've gone past all the crowds, there's a massive assembly area at the top where all the cars wait until the last car comes up, and then you all go back down the hill. And that's actually when all the drivers get out of their cars and they have a good powwow and we all chat to each other and so on and so forth. And it's great. And there is actually a big, big grandstand up there, but we're just kind of all chatting to each other. And Jensen, and what struck Stirling is the most impressive thing that happened that he saw that entire weekend was Jensen came up in the car, got out of the car, ignored every other driver up there, and just spent the entire time that they were waiting with the crowd, signing autographs, doing selfies, and just being there for his fans. He realised what was actually important. And with the rest of us, you know, we're just going chat, 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 chat. And Jensen actually was the guy who actually thought, no, that's not what I'm here for. And Stirling just said that was the most impressive thing he'd seen all weekend. And I think, again, that just shows the calibre of the man.
It does. He's very forthcoming, very generous. And I saw that on this call that I did with him and his colleagues. And we did this thing over Zoom. So there are five of us on this call. I'm trying to conduct an interview. It's not the easiest thing to do because the sound quality is not great. Everyone's chopping, jumping in over one another. It's difficult. It's difficult to do. But he and Ant Anstead made it really easy, actually, because they were very forthcoming, very generous with their time. And they were just a pleasure to talk to. So I'm going to play a little bit from the interview now. The first voice you'll hear is Ant's. And then, of course, Jensen comes in. So have a quick listen.
We talk very passionately with this project. The word timing keeps coming up. And it's because it is, you know, kind of fascinating timing. If you think about the timing of particularly Mark Jensen, I, three Brits, just happened to be here in California exactly the same time. We happen to be exactly the same age. We happen to be one a designer, one a builder, one a driver at a time where heritage has now come full circle. It's back. You know, OEMs, Aston are building a DB5s, Jags are building C-types, D-types, even Bentley will offer you a 1930s blower. So there's something in the air at the moment. And then to partner up with Roger, whilst reviving this new brand, whilst an OEM or many OEMs are willing to partner with us, it's all about weird timing.
Very excited schoolboys, but with lots of experience and hopefully skill. This is super exciting, and you know, once you're able to see what Mark has designed, it's really bloody exciting.
So, Jensen, is this the sort of thing that you imagined yourself getting into once your full time racing days are behind you, or did this opportunity appear and you thought, I have to?
Well, I think every driver that races in F1, you know, when they retire, they hope to be probably working with a manufacturer post F1, you know, as an ambassador for the future. And for me, I've jumped around with different manufacturers, and I've worked with a few, one in particular, but it just didn't go in the same direction with, you know, thinking about the future. And this, I thought, was a fantastic opportunity because it's not working with one manufacturer as such, but it's working with you know, a brand that has so much history, obviously puts a lot of pressure on our shoulders because we have to do a fantastic job, but such an exciting brand of what they've achieved in the past, Bradford, but also I think what we can achieve with new technologies. Also, it's freedom for me. You know, you don't really get that with manufacturers as such. It's freedom to design and build something that we want within reason. And for me, I can do as much testing as I possibly want, and I can adjust the car how I want it. You know, with the motor, with the gearbox, the mechanical grip, the aero. So there's lots to play with, and we can turn things around pretty quickly with new technologies like 3D printing, whether it's the parts or it's a tooling that we're going to be making. So yeah, it's really, really exciting for me, and something I've really enjoyed so far working with these guys. And there's so much to come in a very short space of time.
So they're not saying an awful lot about what they're up to now. They're just announcing this new project, relaunching Radford as a sort of modern day coach building concern. We're going to see, they say that they're working with several OEMs, and they're not just dropping new bodies on top of existing cars. They're really getting stuck into the nuts and bolts engineering as well. So they're going to be working on chassis and engines and aero parts, as well as the bodies and the cabins. We've spoken quite a lot in the past about what we suspect is a new era of coach building. We've said that, haven't we? That we think that perhaps there'll be companies dropping really beautiful bodies on top of standardized electric platforms. But also, it ties into the resto mod thing. We think there'll be companies springing up to restore and modify existing petrol engine cars. You know, similar to what Singer and Alphaholic and Eagle have been doing for a while. And it just seems that Jensen and his mates have recognised something similar and are getting in on the action.
It's very interesting that this Zoom call that you had with them, they're all in LA, I think, weren't they?
That's right.
Yeah. So, okay, so we're recording this on Friday. It goes out on Tuesday. But so last Thursday, for those listening to this, I did 2 hours on the Smoking Tire podcast. Smoking Tire is one of the really, really big podcasts in the US. A couple of great blokes do it, Matt Farah and Zach Clapman. And we were talking about this sort of stuff. And they, out there, they are so far ahead of us. With just creating stuff, the sort of stuff that you were talking. He was telling me about there's an electric Ferrari out there. Someone has done an EV 308 GTB. So there's a 308 which caught fire, burned, or the engine did. So they pulled that out. And there is now somewhere in California, there's an electric 308 running around. And I'm still trying to work out exactly how I feel about that. But I think you're right. I mean, you know, I sort of think we are on the cusp of such enormous change. And obviously, EVs present some huge challenges to people who love driving cars because of all the things that we've talked about, you know, weight and recharging and lack of noise and all this sort of stuff. But clearly, too, there are opportunities, aren't they? Over there in the US, they are so far ahead. I mean, they were saying there are so many businesses which have just sprung up and they're just doing this stuff. Exactly what you're talking about. They are just using, you know, that kind of roller skate architecture where you can just put any kind of body on an EV. Or, you know, he was talking about a Willys Jeep EV that he, so Matt Farah was talking about a Willys Jeep EV that he'd driven. And it's literally, you know, the battery pack is the same size of the, same shape and size of the engine. It's almost plug and play. You pull one out and you put the other in, you hook it up to the same gearbox, run it through the same diff, and off you go. And that's, you know, I think that's going to be, I mean, it's not going to be the way the world goes, but it's going to be the way that a much larger chunk of the world than we are currently aware of is going to go. I mean, I'm interested in it. I want to drive a few of these things. I'm not convinced by them yet. In towns, yeah, clearly, there's going to be a huge demand for them, but at least it's interesting.
It seems Radford are going to be doing much. They're not just EVs, actually. They are going to be working on combustion engine cars.
Yeah.
I think we're going to see their first car later this year. They haven't told me what it is. I don't know. But, for example, what if there is a client out there or a small number of clients who have a McLaren Senna and they love driving it on track, perhaps, but they get ribbed all the time for the way it looks because it's an unusual-looking car. Now, what if an independent organisation came along, offered a new, very beautiful body for it, and perhaps Jensen Button made some amendments to the way that car drove. That is quite an interesting thing, I think. And I suspect that's the sort of stuff that they're going to be getting stuck into. I don't know, that's a bit of a guess, but we'll see. And I think it's quite an interesting project. In that whole interview, by the way, it's up on our YouTube channel. The whole thing's also on Instagram, so you can go and watch it if you want to. Jensen also talks a bit more about other stuff. He talks about Extreme E, which he's going to be doing this year. He talks a little bit about F1 punditry and life out in LA. So go and have a watch. I think he's just a good lad, and he is genuinely one of my motorsport heroes. So it was just very, very cool to get 20 minutes or so to chat with him. He also said he checked out the intercooler while we were on the call. He's followed Drive Nation and the intercooler for a while now, but while we were on the call, he jumped off, had a quick look at it, and he came back and said, "That's very cool."
That's
quite good, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, he could just be saying that because he's a nice bloke or he wants something from us, but I suspect he probably does think it's quite cool. Exactly.
Good. Right, okay. More important matters, though, Andrew. Much more important than Jensen Button and his new coach-building concern.
Yeah.
You've bought a car.
I've bought a car. That's more important than anything, isn't it? I mean, you know, forget COVID, you know.
Headline,
I've bought a car. Yeah, I bought a car yesterday. I bought a Caterham. It's an itch which won't go away. I think this is my fourth, but I've not had one for years and years and years. It was kind of when I was a kid. I could still remember the day I first saw a Caterham go past. It might have even been a Lotus back then. And just looking at this insect-like, super low-slung thing and just thinking, that's just a bit of me. I've been so into them all my life. So before I was a motoring journalist, I had a Caterham 7, which I destroyed showing off to my mates at Goodwood back in the mid-80s, I guess. And then me and a few of the boys at Autocar, James May being one of them, built a Caterham. Well, we tried to build a Caterham. The idea was that we would... carry a load of cardboard boxes into a shed on a Friday evening and drive a Caterham out of the same shed on a Monday morning. It didn't quite happen like that, not least because Caterham didn't supply enough of the parts. It was missing a steering wheel and stuff like that, which was fairly important. But then that's the car that we then gave back to Caterham. And Jez Coates of Caterham described it as the worst built car he'd ever seen. So Caterham then completely rebuilt it for us, and I don't think we put that in the story. But I then ran it as my long-termer for 6 months. I did massive miles in it. I went cruising around. That was the car. I went on holiday in France with my then girlfriend, and thought to myself, well, if she could put up with this, she should probably, she's probably a keeper. I didn't propose to her in it, but I did decide to propose to her in that Caterham. And my then girlfriend is now my wife and has been for many, many years. So I have that to be thankful to Caterham for. And I must have had some money at some stage, because I think in about 97, 98, I just decided I was going to do one thing I'd never done, which is spec my own Caterham from scratch. And the Superlight R, which then I think turned into the R400, didn't it, had just come out. So with that crazy VHPD 192 horsepower 1.8 litre K-series motor in it. So I got one of those. It was in a colour scheme that had never been done before. It was black with a yellow stripe. It looked like a bumblebee. And apparently a few have been done like that since. It was just a mega car. And looking about,
like, is this the one that you saw at Spa years after selling?
Yes, it is. Yes, exactly the same car. So I don't know why I sold it, because I used to drive it out to the Nürburgring. There used to be a company, a track day company called. It'll come back to me anyway. And I used to do some stuff. It's actually with the company that I used to do some instructing at the ring for. It's really annoying me. I've forgotten the name. Doesn't matter. Anyway, they used to go and book 2 days at the Nürburgring and then a day at Spa on the way home. So you do like three days, one after the other. It was amazing. Wheel talk. There you go. I remember now. They went bust. Anyway, and I used to take the 7 out and do these things in it, and I had a ball. And then I sold it, and I can't remember why. But a while after that, I was at Spa doing a track day, and I saw the car. And the bloke came up to me and went, I just love this thing. And the only really stupid thing I did was drive it. He said, you've got to have a go. And he hadn't changed it at all. And I just remember doing. I think I came in early. I was so miserable. I just think, you know, such an idiot. You have sold this thing, and yeah, that was 23 years ago, I suppose. And although I've driven 1,000 since, I've not owned one. And then I, what did I do? I sold my 205 GTI on collecting cars, and I was very lucky because a couple of people really wanted it. So there was a bit of a bidding war, and I just got much more money for it than I thought I would. So I found myself, and so what I should have done always is you then bank the cash, don't you? You kind of make, you know, you just kind of, you know, make a bit of a hole in the mortgage. But I didn't do that. I bought a caterer.
Good work.
So the caterer I have bought is a car I didn't think existed, because people who know caterers will know that in the old days they made live axle cars with four-speed gearboxes and old pushrod Ford Kent engines. And then sometime in the late 1980s, early 1990s, they started making cars with almost proper De Dion rear suspension, and they had modern Rover K-series engines in them and five or six-speed gearboxes, and you know, everything kind of changed then. But what I really wanted was a car with an old Kent engine in it, just like the car that I'd written off at Goodwood, because I just love the motor in that. I mean, it's not a great motor, but it has got so much character. But I couldn't put up with the fact that I wouldn't fit in the thing, and the ride quality would be terrible. It would only have four gears and all this sort of stuff, so all the limitations of the old Caterhams. And then suddenly, I was cruising around all the websites of people who sell these things, and there's a company called Sevenson Classics, which is run by a bloke called Andy Noble, who used to be the sales director at Caterham. And Andy I've known for years and years and years, and I just like him and I just trust him. And suddenly on his website, this car turned up. So it's a 1997 car, so very much from the modern era. So, you know, with the De Dion axle and the long cockpit, which means I fit in the thing, but it had a crossflow in it. And like, you know, I'd kind of forgotten they even made these cars, because there was actually some crossover between the sort of K-series cars and the crossflow cars. So I just went down there, and I, you know, and the stupid thing is I kind of knew I'd buy it the moment I got in the thing. I ran it around the block, drove it for about 10 miles, came back and went, yep, fine, I'll have it. So, yeah, so they've got to do a few things to it. They've got to drop the floor a bit because I can get a bit more comfortable. I put a spacer on the steering wheel. But the car is, you know, the engine is... You know, although it's the original 1997 engine, it's brand new because some mad Frenchman rebuilt it 2 years ago, and it's done no miles since. And I just couldn't be more excited. It's not, you know, it's not a flash Caterham. It's never going to go near a racetrack. I'm just going to use it for bimbling around here. And hopefully all my mates will come over and they can bimble about in it too. It's one of those cars that, you know, half the fun is just watching your mates drive it. And just, particularly if they've never driven a Caterham like that before, and just seeing how much fun you can have in 15 grand's worth of motor car. Because it's off the scale. So when I've got it, why don't you take your Alpine and I'll take my Caterham, and you know, there are two more different approaches to the business, other than being kind of really, really light, but to the business of having fun on four wheels, you'd struggle to find. But they both do their jobs in such utterly different ways so well. I think we could do a little bit about that, couldn't we?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that'd be great. So we'll see your car on the intercooler soon. We'll get it together with my car. We'll swap seats. You've not driven my car yet, actually.
No.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Great. Well, congratulations on your new Caterham. That's exciting.
Did I bang on a bit too much about that? The problem with things, when the subject is Caterhams, the moment you start me, I'm quite difficult to stop. I could do another 20 minutes if you like.
That's fine. We'll revisit it later on once you've actually got the car. We should probably let you take delivery first, shouldn't we? Before talking
minor
about
detail.
It again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Great. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing more. Okay. Final thing that I want to discuss this week on the podcast. Aston Martin, today actually, have announced a new Vantage. It's called the Vantage F1 Edition. Not many road cars have carried F1 badging, have they?
Well, I can think of a McLaren. Beyond that,
yeah.
There's not much, is there?
It's interesting. I think you can get an F1 cockapoo. That's a bit different. But this
what's an this F1 cockapoo?
I don't know. I'd have to ask someone. But it's to do with how they're bred and what its parents are or something. I don't know. I think it's a first generation cockapoo.
So it's really, really fast, but it breaks down
fast.
All the time.
Yeah, exactly. It's lightweight. Yeah, loads of power. So Aston Martin have done this F1 edition Vantage. Now it's partly because they're going back to F1 this season, but also because they're sharing safety car responsibilities with Mercedes AMG this year, aren't they? So we will see Vantages running around at the front of the pack and DBX at the back of the pack as well as the medical car. And so to bring the Vantage up to scratch for safety car duties, they did a bit of re-engineering on it. They and what they've effectively done is transposed all that engineering work onto a version of the Vantage for sale to the public. It's the most powerful version of the current Vantage with, what have we got, 535 PS. So what's that, 527 BHP or something like that.
Okay, so it's like, what, 25 more than it's got normally?
So exactly, it's like 25
more. It's sort of like a 5% upgrade. So it's something. You'll notice it, but it's not...
It's something, but they've done a lot of fine-tuning work to the steering and the suspension and the aero as well. It sounds like they've gone deep with the chassis, actually. And I quite like this line. Improve lap time performance in order to successfully carry out its role on the F1 track, but without compromising its on-road capabilities. Notably, it would do so without the fitment of aggressively track-optimized tyres. So that's quite good, isn't it? They're not just slinging a set of Cup 2s on it. They're finding... improvements in the chassis itself. I think that's quite a neat approach.
That's quite interesting, isn't it? Is it a limited edition car, or is it? Have they said that, or what they're going to charge for it? Or
yeah, they're charging $142,000 for it. It's on sale now. Deliveries begin in May, actually. So it's actually not that much more expensive.
And if it was a limited edition, they'd have said so, wouldn't they? So I think we can presume it's not.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I think they will do. I mean. Yeah, gosh, it's no secret, is it, that they've struggled with that car? Certainly from the first off, sales were not what they hoped that they would be. I think the perception is that the styling wasn't great and the price point was wrong. But I think, you know, clearly it doesn't need another 25 horsepower and to be a safety car in Formula One. I'm quite sure that, you know, you could provide perfectly adequate safety car facilities on 503 horsepower. But I think that the way that they are leveraging that association, I think it's quite canny. And I think, you know, you can think, well, it's all just cynical marketing, and it probably is. But, you know, these guys got to sell cars, and I think that's probably quite a smart thing to be doing. And then also to be able to put the F1 on there. I think that there's a certain constituency of punter who thinks that's really, really cool. I bet they've all got grills on them, haven't they? Have any of the pictures, they've all got cars with the new front grille on it?
It's got the new grille.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, but I'll be a fair play to them.
As far as I can tell, it's 8-speed auto only. But, yeah. Potentially, that's a shame. But I don't know, it'll be fun to drive. I mean, there'll be some very clever marketing people who have looked at this and calculated the TV airtime that they'll get from the safety car stuff that they'll be doing this season. To someone like me, though, and perhaps it's true for you as well, I just wonder how good that association is, because this is the safety car, right? This is the car that comes out to slow the pack down. It's not the fun car. It's not the excitement car, is it? It's the safety car. So I don't know. It seems a bit dubious to me, perhaps. And I just think if your mate buys one of these cars and you all toddle off to go for a bit of a drive and you're driving in convoy and he's at the front of the pack in his Vantage F1 edition, imagine you've all got walkie-talkies. Someone's going to come on the radio and say, "Can the safety car speed up, please?" They just are, aren't they?
Yes, they are. But actually, gosh, you know, I'm going to disagree with you in public as well as in private. I actually think that, it's the safety car. But you know what? It's an Aston Martin scene leading a pack of Formula One cars. I think the association is. And also, you know, what they should do, they might get into trouble, but what they should do is they should get Bernd Mailänder. They should just say to him, look, if it's raining, okay, and the safety car comes out, you've just got to do lots of skids. Yeah,
you've
just got to drift it absolutely everywhere, because we got, and you can say, we've got to provide, you know, while people are waiting for this race to restart, we've got to provide them with some entertainment. I know that's probably not what a safety car is meant to be doing, but actually, yeah, I mean, it's worked for Mercedes, isn't it? You know, they wouldn't have had that AMG GTR out there for as long as they have. And I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that it's shared duties between Mercedes and Aston Martin. I don't know where they're going to alternate. So the safety car and the medical car are going to be Mercedes one race and then an Aston Martin to the next. I don't know how that's going to work. But even for Aston Martin to be seen making those associations, to be in that company, and to be leading that field, you know, I'm not a marketing man, thank goodness, because I wouldn't be very good at it. But I suspect it's going to work for them, even if owners do occasionally have to put up a bit of with a bit of stick from their mates.
You're going to come out one day and it's going to have an orange light bar on the top and a big sticker down the side saying safety car. Anyway, well, I hope I haven't robbed myself of an opportunity to have a blast in this Vantage F1 edition.
Do we know anything else that they're going to be? I mean, okay, it's 25 horsepower. And that's great. I mean, you know, I'm not going to turn my nose. But we know, don't we, that engine will go far further than that. We know also, even though Aston Martin will probably deny it or just say it's so difficult, we probably wouldn't do it. But we do know kind of that the V12 will go under that bonnet because it's the same platform as, you know, as the DBS and the DB11. So I just wonder where Aston Martin's going to go with that car. I think all I'm trying to say now is, you know, don't think this is the end of that story. This is the last of the performance Vantages, because I can't see, given that Mercedes now owns more of the company than they used to, given that the old head of AMG is now running the country, given that we know that engine will go to, you know, 600 and plenty horsepower, and given that we know that there's a V12, which will slot in whatever Aston Martin says, I think there could be a lot coming on that with that car down the road, and we may end up at the end of its life feeling very different things about it to what we felt about it at the beginning of its life.
Interesting. It could evolve quite a long way, couldn't it, that car? Yeah, I mean, the Speedster, that windscreenless one, that's Vantage-based, isn't it? It's got the V12, so we can be pretty confident it does fit. And the previous V12 Vantage was such a spectacular car, so characterful.
It's the best modern Aston Martin. They obviously made the V12 Vantage, and then they made the V12 Vantage S, and then they put the 7-speed manual in the V12 Vantage. I actually think the original car, they are such good value at the moment. You know, an original V12 Vantage with a 6-speed manual in it, because the 7-speed was, you know, it was great that it was a manual V12 Vantage, yes, but it wasn't actually that great a gearbox. But an old 6-speed V12 Vantage is probably, to me, the greatest modern Aston Martin, might even be the greatest Aston Martin. So I just hope that they recapture that with this car.
Yeah, let's hope so. Okay, well, let's leave it there. Thank you, everybody, for watching or for listening. And just stay tuned over the next week or so, the next couple of weeks. Stay tuned. We're going to be telling you who's going to be writing for our new digital magazine, what kind of form it will take. We've got an awful lot to tell you on that front. So stay tuned.
Just two things. What I said at the beginning is we're not going to stop doing any of the stuff that we're already doing. You and I are still going to record these podcasts. The Instagram site will continue. What we are going to be doing is, you know, this is going to be anything other than just another car-themed website. It is going to be different, both in the way that it is and also the people that we have contributing to it. It is a big jump into the unknown. It's not something that's ever been tried before. We're confident, but, you know, as I keep on saying to everybody who will listen who's involved with this, you know, we may judge ourselves by what we feel capable of. Everybody else will judge us on what we've already achieved. So we have no complacency, we have no preconceptions, but we're going to give it a go. And that's just really exciting. And I really, really hope you guys like it. I hope that you you know, come over and enjoy it, and we just really look forward to telling you more about it.
Yeah, and we will over the next few days, so stay tuned. Yeah. Thank you again for listening, everyone. Make sure you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you're watching this on YouTube, go and subscribe to this channel as well. We will be doing more with this YouTube channel, and we'll be back to talk to you all again next week.
Yeah, look forward to it. Thanks so much. All the best.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.